This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 1st of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we've been popping our corn early to present a roundup of two of last week's film festivals that really set the pace for the rest of the year, Sundance and Trieste. While the mainstream was focusing on the run-up to the red carpet at the Oscars, the rest of the film industry is still busy making movies, showing them and doing distribution deals. What might your local cinema be playing later this year? Which genres seem like a good bet to distribute? And how is new technology creeping on screen, even in the more independent world of Sundance and Trieste?
We're looking at a field being born. It is a historic festival, a historic moment, and not only are we seeing these 30 works coming from different kinds of developers, different areas of artistic practice, we are also seeing an industry starting to form around it.
So this will be our film festival omnibus on which we'd love you to hop aboard. It's Culture on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound. The Sundance Film Festival is the largest celebration of American independent film in the country and a chance for movie lovers and industry types to flock en masse to Park City. For 11 days, the Utah ski resort changes beyond all recognition as shops are converted, makeshift cinemas are constructed, and the snow is wrestled under control. Over 100 features, docs, shorts and world cinema offerings are shown, alongside talks, art installations and, of course, some parties. Monocle's New York bureau chief, Ed Stocker, was in town to meet the people behind the festival, which finished yesterday, ensuring that the event keeps going, whatever the weather, year after year.
It's hard to imagine what Park City must be like when Sundance isn't on. Right now, the ski runs are mostly quiet. All activity is centred on Main Street. People spill out of the Egyptian Theatre. Others queue to get into the C&M Films Lounge, a shop commandeered by the network for the festival. The logistics are staggering.
Park City goes under a pretty radical transformation.
John Stevenson is Sundance Assistant Director of Production and Transportation.
We have 16 cinemas, and some of them are existing, you know, built commercial cinemas, and then others are ones that we transform. Like a basketball court gymnasium into a 500-seat cinema. We turn a hotel ballroom into a cinema. We turn a room in a synagogue into a cinema. So if there's a big open space in town, we try to convert it into something that we can use, either for a cinema or for a party.
Somehow, it all manages to come off. Whoever had the idea, yes you, Robert Redford and co, of hosting a film festival in the Utah mountains in winter must have been, well, a glutton for punishment, to be honest. Because sometimes the heavens conspire, meaning weather turning from fair to a serious snow dumping in a matter of hours. Many a Los Angeles resident dusting off their designer snow gear for a few days and enjoying a brief flirt with sub-zero temperatures has paid the price for inadequate footgear. Wipeouts have been known to happen. John Stevenson remembers a particularly bad year when 2 feet of snow fell in about 12 hours.
The roads were gridlocked. I had all of my staff out shoveling snow, pushing cars out of ditches. And it was exhausting, but we made it through that day. It was the opening Saturday. You know, we made it through, and afterward we're able to laugh about it, but it was exhausting and stressful.
Across town, Dana Williams, the populist former mayor who retired a couple of years ago after serving 3 terms, is taking it all in his stride.
The logistics are amazing. I mean, needless to say, it's not like we start a few weeks before the festival to get ready for it. But I think to a certain extent, because of who we are and what we do, we're used to this. So we're used to staging events, and we're used to realizing that we might get a foot or two of snow, and there's an event the next day.
Williams, who got to introduce the opening night of the festival for his 12 years as mayor, says that Park City balloons from a population of around 8,500 to 30,000 plus. This year they're expecting even more, and that means better planning and longer days for those behind the scenes.
And it's kind of like we know what we do for a living, and there's plenty of time to sleep in the summer.
In truth, the weather fails to cause major disruptions, and the breathtaking views of the mountains are part of what makes this festival so special. Skiing, anyone?
When you're here with the film, it's very hard to go ski because you're pretty much being dragged around from thing to thing. But when you don't have a film here, it's actually the best time in the world to ski because most people are watching movies, so the slopes are generally pretty open.
Matt Heineman is the director of Mexican border documentary Cartel Land, recently nominated for an Oscar. The film played at the festival last year, meaning Heineman can snap on those boots and head for the slopes this year. His film's success is a clear indicator of how Sundance sets the bar for quality documentaries in the country, one of the festival's biggest strengths.
Sundance, you know, has been amazing to me, both the Institute itself supporting my last two films and also having my last two films play here at the festival. You know, there's really no better place in the world to launch a documentary. The exposure you get, the press you get, the audiences are incredible, and just the culture and the love of film and documentary is amazing. And so I feel very fortunate to be part of this family.
And it does feel like a family setup. Most of the staff who work year-round on the festival have become permanent residents of Park City, including logistics man John Stevenson. The festival, of course, has come a long way since its inception, though.
It was a pretty rough and tumble beginning.
Nan Chalat Noka is the wonderfully laid-back, motherly editor of local newspaper The Park Record. A peace symbol necklace dangles from around her neck. Nowadays, she acknowledges, the festival is perhaps busier and there might be more commercial interests on the sidelines jockeying for a position.
But that's not what I feel is the heart of the festival, nor the part that I love, which is the struggling artists who've just spent their last dime trying to get a film in the festival, and they're here in a borrowed car and the wrong shoes. So I think that's what the spirit of the festival is really about.
Those wrong shoes, indeed. Do please watch your step on the way to that screening.
So that's the logistics out of the way, but what about the movies themselves? The big headlines from Sundance this year were the presence of Netflix and Amazon, who both went on a bit of a spending frenzy at the festival. But the film that went for the most was Nate Parker's The Birth of a Nation, which Fox Searchlight snapped up for a whopping $17.5 million, a record breaker for Sundance. Parker's hotly tipped movie was a hit at the awards too, taking both the Grand Jury Prize and the Audience Award. On the doc side of things, one of this year's big winners was Jim, the James Foley Story, a portrait of the American video journalist who was killed by ISIS in 2014. The film snapped up the Audience Award in the documentary category. Last week, Ed reviewed Jim for the Monocle Arts Review, presented by Gillian DeBias.
This was directed by someone who's actually been in the film industry for a long time, but this is his first feature as director. Brian Oakes is the name of the person, and he's actually a childhood friend of James Foley. So he had incredible access because it turns out, you know, all the family was on board when it came to making this film. I mean, when I first heard about this film, I felt slightly uncomfortable. My first question to myself was, is this a bit too soon? You know, James Foley was killed only in 2014. It's been less than 2 years. But then you watch the film and you see how eloquent and on board his entire family are. And it feels like they really want to talk about this. And because they know the director, they're obviously clearly extremely comfortable talking about it with him because he's, you know, almost a member of their extended family. So he manages to get, you know, very open, frank interviews from all the family members there.
Certainly a level of trust. Well, let's hear a clip from the documentary, Jim.
These four guys with guns, they stop the taxi and they put Jim into the back of their van. I didn't know if I was going to see him again.
We didn't know who was holding him. I was frantic.
ISIS was on nobody's radar.
They threatened to kill Jim.
I hadn't heard Jim's voice in 2 years.
I never, ever imagined that it would end in that fashion.
We lost all hope in captivity, but James didn't. He saw the light instead of the dark.
There's physical courage, but that's nothing compared to moral courage. If I don't have that moral courage, we don't have journalism.
A clip from the documentary Jim, the James Foley story, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. Now, Ed, there was so much media coverage leading up to and, of course, after his death. What does this documentary add to this subject?
You know, at the beginning of the film, there's almost like a mission statement from the director. He clearly states that he's not going to show the execution of his friend. The film isn't about that. In terms of what it does show, I mean, you can almost say it's slightly simplistic, the first half. It really is talking head interviews with family members and some friends. So we get a bit of background about who was Jim Foley. We learn that he was quite a restless character. He was great with people. He had wanderlust. He decided he wanted to be a journalist after doing some teaching before that. Perhaps nothing especially riveting, although certainly interesting. I think actually what makes this film is the second half. It really adds something that I certainly didn't know before watching it, which was there was a reenactment of his time in captivity, which was, you know, subtly done. But what was really incredible was all the interviews with the fellow journalists who were captured with him, talking about what his character was like, talking about their time in captivity, how the guards were with them, their nicknames, the comedy that arose in the most tragic and horrific of situations was really touching and, you know, extremely moving hearing those people talking. And actually at the screening I was at, there was a Q&A afterwards with the entire family and all those people in captivity. One of the most amazing things that I didn't know was one of the Danish journalists who was released, Jim went to give him a letter to give to his family. And this journalist didn't want to leave prison with this letter. He was scared that if he got caught with it, he wouldn't be set free. So what he did apparently was memorize it. He spent the whole of the night before his release remembering every letter in there. And then at the end of the film, at the end of this documentary, we hear that letter being read out to Jim's family. And I tell you, there was not a dry eye left in that cinema, including myself at the end of it.
That was Ed Stocker speaking to Monocle's Gillian DeBias on episode 230 of the Arts Review. To hear his reviews of the other documentaries, Nuts and Life Illustrated, both of which won awards at this year's Sundance, then you can download the show on iTunes, SoundCloud or Monocle.com. Stick around, because after the break, we'll be immersing ourselves fully in the Sundance experience as we sample some virtual reality.
Monocle loves books. We love them so much that we have our very own books team in partnership with our friends at Gestalten in Berlin. We've already launched the muscular and handsome Monocle Guide to Better Living and the Monocle Guide to Good Business, plus the London and New York titles in our new hardback City Guide series. And coming your way this summer are the giant Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes that's packed with inspiring residences and practical advice, and City Guides for Hong Kong and Tokyo too. Monocle's books offer a world of new experiences between the covers, whether you're staying at home or seeking new adventures. See our full lineup of well-turned-out titles at monocle.com and on the shelves of all great bookstores.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. And today we're at the Sundance Film Festival in Utah, and also later we'll be in Trieste. The New Frontier segment at Sundance celebrated its 10th anniversary this year. An integral part of the film festival is an experimental world where art and film fuse. But this year, the big buzz has been about virtual reality. While this may not be the first time virtual reality films have been shown at New Frontier, they've come on leaps and bounds, jumping from 12 offerings last year to over 30 at the 2016 edition. Spanning everything from nature films to portrayals of police brutality, filmmakers are becoming increasingly confident with this newest of mediums, aided by ever better technology. And Ed stayed in town to strap on a headset and got immersed.
The New Frontier building on Main Street in Park City, filmmakers showcasing more than 30 movies over two floors, installations by the likes of Khalil Joseph, and everywhere people plugged into headsets, moving their heads as they get lost in a world of virtual reality.
The setup of our installation in Sundance New Frontier is a room that represents the same basement that is part of our virtual reality experience. So we are having three people watch it at the same time.
Rosie, Rosie, Roo!
New York-based Serbian director Milica Zets is describing her VR setup.
We have three chairs. It's a 10 by 12 room. They enter into the dark space and they only see the projection of the title of the movie, Giant. They put virtual reality headset on and then the experience starts.
Is that the giant for real, Mommy?
Based on her personal experiences of being in Belgrade in the 1990s during the NATO bombings, the film tells the story of an American family hiding in a basement during a bombing. To stop their six-year-old daughter being afraid, the parents invent a playful story about a giant. Zet soon realized that when it came to telling this story, she didn't want to make a traditional short.
I wanted people to experience, actually, what is it to be in a war situation. It came to my mind that we should maybe make a virtual reality short film out of it.
So what is VR? It can be anything from a 360-degree live-action film to a CGI world, or in the case of Giant, a fusion of both.
You know, granted, the technology is still very much in its infancy.
Winslow Porter is co-creator of Giant.
Maybe with the DK2 or like the earlier Oculus, it was like the Atari stage of VR, and now we're kind of approaching like the Super Nintendo, like with the new Rifts and the new Vives that are coming out. It's still very rudimentary, but it allows, even with the most basic versions of VR, a proof of concept for how immersive it can be.
Giant's filmmakers said they changed headsets four times during the making, an indicator of how quickly things are changing. One gets the sense that VR is taking its first steps. A New Frontiers programmer, Shari Frilo, agrees.
We're looking at a field being born. It is a historic festival, a historic moment. And not only are we seeing these 30 works coming from different kinds of developers, different areas of artistic practice, we are also seeing an industry starting to form around it.
The films on display are certainly varied.
I said, put the phone down. Put it down.
From fictions and reenactments of police brutality to documentaries and nature epics. James Spinney is co-director of Notes on Blindness, based on the audio diaries of Australian John Hull, who recorded losing his sight.
And so we're really keen to try and find a way that some of the more sensory passages that are so poetically expressed in John's account, you know, might find an audience.
The resulting VR experience, alongside a separate feature film, is remarkably meditative and beautiful. And while VR can sometimes make you feel slightly nauseous, a result of its infancy, this one is calming. The film, alongside the VR experience, will be released in UK cinemas by Curzon later this year. Yet investigative journalism had an outing at New Frontier too. With the New York Times already establishing itself as a major VR player with last year's The Displace film, The Guardian, it seems, also wants in on the act.
Welcome to your cell. You're going to be here for 23 hours a day.
I saw some virtual reality projects about a year and a half ago and was really struck by the kind of potential for the medium. Back then, there weren't that many documentaries or journalistic pieces out, but like it was really obvious that there was something there.
Francesca Panetta is the director of 6x9, a CGI film exploring solitary confinement in the US. Viewers are taken inside the cell, while audio from a real prison, interviews with ex-inmates, and text displayed on the cell walls feed you information. Set for release in April, Panetta sees a bright future for VR.
I look back at what there was 2 years ago and at the selection of what's here at Sundance, and it's, you know, leaps ahead. So absolutely, I'm desperate to do more, really.
She's not the only one to see the potential. With headsets coming down in price and constant tech improvements, Goldman Sachs recently predicted that the market would be worth $80 million by 2025.
I've been watching this development. Every 3 months, it jumps by quantum leaps. The quality gets better. The positional tracking gets better.
That's programmer Shari Frilo again.
You know, now we've got the Vive headsets where instead of sitting in one place and moving around, you can actually walk in a virtual environment in a 10 by 10 foot space.
For Giants' Winslow Porter, a lot is set to change in the coming years.
Right now, the biggest problem with VR is that we're comparing it to things that we know, that we love. There's a wide world of opportunity out there to do something very new, very different, things that we can't fully comprehend right now.
We may not know exactly what the future is, but VR will clearly play a big part in it. For Monocle in Park City, Utah, I'm Ed Stocker.
That concludes our coverage of Sundance this year. Thank you to Ed Stocker. To end the show, we're going to round up a smaller film festival that just wrapped up here in Europe. The Trieste Film Festival has been going since 1989, and it specialises in Central and Eastern European film. We dispatched David Pleasant to that beautiful corner of northeastern Italy to see what's on show and to take the temperature of Eastern European cinema.
As the former port of Austria-Hungary and being surrounded by constantly changing borders of the turbulent 20th century, Trieste is a melting pot of Europe like no other. Very well placed, therefore, to hold the Trieste Film Festival, one of the world's leading events dedicated to the cinema of Central and Eastern Europe. It all started in 1987, when the Berlin Wall was crumbling, and Trieste, just a few kilometres from the Yugoslav border, was again at the centre of a very changing Europe. From Lithuania to Ljubljana and from Serbia to St. Petersburg, filmmakers gather on the shores of the Adriatic to show and watch. The festival director, Nicoletta Romeo, is key to what has become a Mitteleuropa must-see. I pulled her aside from the frenetic festival preparations.
We used to have two venues for the festival, and this year it's three. So the festival will be held in Sala Tripkovic, Teatro Miela, and Cinema dei Fabbri, a little independent cinema in the old part of the city. So the idea is to invade the town and to create more sidebar events, even outside the festival. And then the festival will be 9 days long instead of seven, so it's going to be a little bit of an effort for all of us, but I think it's worthwhile because it means 2 weekends, which means maybe full house again next weekend. I mean, this is what I wish for my festival. This town is multicultural. It's really a bridge between East and West, and the frontier is nearby. I mean, now it's almost absurd to speak about frontiers, although this issue is very hot at the moment. Trieste has always been a privileged observatory towards these countries, and it still has many relationships with these countries, which are not only economical and political, but cultural. And in Trieste, there are lots of minorities, like the Serbian minority, which is a very large one, and the Slovenian, of course, Croats, many Austrians, Americans. So it makes sense, I mean, that this festival was born here, and it's still going on very, very well.
Location, funding, a regional support network, and cultural reputation are important. But at Trieste Film Festival, as with any film festival, it is, of course, all about the big screen. Or three screens in this case. I met the man who ultimately decides what shows and what doesn't, and found out what it takes to make the cut.
I'm Fabrizio Grosoli. I'm the artistic director of Trieste Film Festival. The most important thing for us is to find out talented directors, fresh and original films from everywhere. For instance, I was in charge ruling the documentary competition, and I can say that since 2005 and now, there is an impressive growing quality situation in documentary production, which really affects, of course, the process of selection. So the documentary, not only for competition, but in general the presence of the documentaries is very big now. It's important for us, and I can say the most experimental and new products are from that side.
As Fabrizio alluded to there, it seems that never before has the documentary taken so much of the centre stage in the filmmaking world. Like the borders in this part of the world, the boundaries and opportunities of the documentary genre are ever evolving. Although state and regional film commissions are certainly alive and kicking in many countries in Eastern and Central Europe, it is perhaps little surprise, and as happened with the making of screenplays, it is private American money that is fueling the documentary boom. At the 900-seat Sala Tripkovich Theatre, I met one Romanian director whose film is a vocal embodiment of the unexpected cultural exchanges that happen when East meets West.
My name is Ilinka Calugareanu. I'm the director of Chuck Norris vs. Communism, a documentary that's in competition here.
No, nici nu are rost să discutăm pe asta.
Prea multă mâncare. Produse. Uite, uite.
Dar se taie.
Tăiem sigur.
Vedeai niște filme, probabil băgate în țară ilegal.
Those were the sounds of Romanian director Ilinca Calugareanu's new documentary, Chuck Norris vs. Communism.
In this moment, I'm happy because I'm here.
Dopo successivamente, se volete, sono qui disponibile per ulteriori informazioni.
Grazie.
And that was another Romanian documentary there that also treats the deep roots of cinema culture, Alexandru Bell's intriguing portrayal of the trials and tribulations of one of Romania's last surviving state-owned cinemas, as seen through Victor Purițe, its charismatic projectionist. Trieste Film Festival stands out for the range and depth in which it covers Central and Eastern European cinema. It brings some of the many newfound treasures from the other side of the former Iron Curtain to eager Italian and Western eyes. For parting words, there can be no more Eastern European than Latvian journalist Ivans, who I met just before the screening of Polish director Marcin Kozalska's feature Red Spider.
Ivan Spelkovs, that is my name. I'm from Eastern Europe. That means I was born in the Southeastern Europe, in Bessarabia, which is Republic of Moldova, but I left it very long ago. But it was in the last year when I decided to move here in Trieste because I found it's a wonderful place. It is really the bridge where East meets West. This town always had a special attention towards all East Europe, from the sea to the sea. And this sea is the warmest one, isn't it?
Diverse, multinational in the true meaning of the word, and endlessly full of surprises, Trieste Film Festival, like its host city, is a gathering like no other. For Monocle in Trieste, I'm David Pleasant.
Thanks, David. And that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer, of course, was Holly, always at the Flicks Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Pound. And thanks for tuning in.